A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. As of April 2026, the world's central banks are sitting on over $15 trillion worth of foreign exchange reserves. That's a number so big it kind of stops meaning anything. In an era of economic uncertainty, understanding what this pile of money is for is absolutely crucial for any serious discussion about fiscal policy, national sovereignty, and financial stability. Also, a quick note for the listeners. Today's episode script is courtesy of DeepSeek V3.2. The friendly AI down the road is lending a hand.
That's a nice upgrade. Okay, 15 trillion. It's a staggering number, but it's also surprisingly abstract. Daniel sent us a prompt that cuts right to the heart of it.
It's basically asking us to unpack the entire global financial system's backstop. What determines that specific amount they hold, and why does this reserve matter so much as an instrument of fiscal and economic policy? There's a lot to unpack here.
We're witnessing a slow but fundamental rewiring of the plumbing of global finance, and these reserves are at the very heart of it. If you want to play in the global economy, you need chips on the table. Those chips are your reserves.
The composition has shifted dramatically. It's not just stacks of dollars and bars of gold anymore, though those are still huge components. But the why and the how much, that's where the real policy chess game begins.
The requirement is more of a pragmatic economic imperative. The classic components are foreign currency itself, overwhelmingly U-dollars, but also euros, yen, pounds, Swiss francs, and then other reserve assets like special drawing rights from the IMF, and of course, gold.
Which has made a massive comeback lately, but we'll get to that. The key point is, these are liquid assets the central bank can use to meet balance of payments needs, influence the exchange rate, and maintain confidence in the national currency. It's the national rainy day fund, but for international transactions.
That's the crucial shift from the gold standard era. Under a pure gold standard, the currency was literally convertible to gold at a fixed rate. Reserves were gold, and the system was designed to be self-correcting through flows of gold between countries. Once that link was broken in the 20th century, the entire philosophy changed. And the purpose is really threefold. First, they let you defend your own currency's exchange rate. If traders start selling your currency, pushing its value down, you can step in and buy it using your foreign reserves to prop it up.
Like a central bank acting as the buyer of last resort for its own money. Can you give us a concrete example of how this plays out in the markets? You hold reserves so that during a shock, say, investors suddenly pull money out of your country, or your export earnings collapse, you have the foreign currency to pay your international bills without your currency completely collapsing. It gives you time to adjust, to implement policy, without being forced into a fire sale or begging for an IMF bailout under punishing terms.
It's a direct, forceful action to counteract market sentiment. Without those dollar reserves, they'd have no defense. The currency could go into freefall. If your currency is plunging too fast, you can sell dollars from your reserves and buy your own currency to prop it up. If it's appreciating too rapidly and hurting your exporters, you can sell your currency and buy dollars, adding to your reserves. Second, they ensure you can always pay your international bills. If a country owes debt in U-dollars, or needs to pay for vital imports like oil or medicine, it needs dollars to do that. Reserves guarantee that liquidity.
Right. And to make that concrete, let's picture a small, open economy like Thailand. If there's a sudden rumor about political instability, international traders might start dumping the Thai baht. The Bank of Thailand can step in and say, not so fast. They sell some of their dollar reserves to buy BART, increasing demand for it and slowing the fall. Without that ability, the drop could become a cliff.
This was brutally illustrated during the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. Countries like South Korea saw their reserves evaporate and were forced into IMF programs that came with strict austerity requirements.
Every central bank has its own risk tolerance. The classic rule of thumb used to be that you should hold enough to cover 3 to 6 months of imports. It's less about a formal requirement and more about the brutal optionality of not having them. You can try to run a modern economy without reserves, but the moment anything goes wrong, you're completely exposed.
That's the trade balance angle. But it's more than just paying for imported iPhones and oil. It's also about your external debt obligations. That's the core of it. And the composition has been shifting dramatically. We mentioned the dollar's declining share. As of last quarter, the dollar made up about 56.8% of allocated reserves.
So you have the import cover metric and the short-term external debt cover metric. The International Monetary Fund has guidelines suggesting reserves should ideally cover all external debt coming due within a year, plus a buffer. What's filling the gap? Is it a coordinated move, or just a bunch of individual decisions adding up? Some economies hold reserves as a percentage of that, to backstop potential capital flight if citizens try to convert their savings to dollars en masse.
Some countries are diversifying quietly, while others, like Russia or Iran facing sanctions, are doing so out of sheer necessity. It's a story of both gradual trend and forced acceleration that itself can deter speculative attacks because traders know you have the firepower to fight back.
That credibility point is critical. It's not a legal requirement, but it's an economic one. The market imposes the requirement. If your reserves dip below what investors deem safe, they'll start demanding higher interest rates to lend to you, or they'll pull money out, creating the very crisis you're trying to avoid. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
The amount is a moving target, a balance between the cost of holding all that foreign currency, which could otherwise be spent on infrastructure or tax cuts, and the perceived risk of not having enough. Great follow-up. It's overwhelmingly short-term government debt.
And those risk calculations shift depending on your economy's structure. Take trade balance, for example. A country running a persistent surplus, like China, naturally accumulates dollars from its export earnings. It's swimming in foreign currency. Conversely, a country with a trade deficit needs to attract foreign investment or dip into its reserves to pay for that gap. That's your first big driver.
Surplus equals pile building, deficit equals pile draining, all else being equal. But what about the debt? You mentioned that earlier.
The second major determinant is the currency composition of your external debt. If your government or your corporations have borrowed in you dollars, you absolutely need dollar reserves to service that debt. This is the single most important variable that popular media coverage consistently ignores. A country can look stable on paper, but if its debts are dollar-denominated and its reserves are low, it's sitting on a trap door. It can't just be a feeling. That looks like enough dollars.
It's definitely not. There are formal metrics for what's called reserve adequacy. The most traditional one is import coverage. The old rule of thumb was you should hold enough foreign currency to pay for 3 to 6 months of your country's imports. Every time you intervene in the market to buy or sell your own currency, you're either spending or adding to your reserves. It's an expensive hobby.
And that's where we see the role of IMF guidelines and global benchmarks. They provide a framework for what adequate looks like, so markets have a common yardstick. The IMF's Assessing Reserve Adequacy Framework looks at those factors we just listed. Potential capital flight, export income shortfalls, and debt servicing, and spits out a recommended range. Most emerging markets target reserves covering at least 100% of their short-term external debt, plus enough to offset potential outflows.
Missing those benchmarks has real consequences. It's like a credit score for countries. Let's put a concrete number on this. The case study that defines this entire conversation is China. They hold the largest reserves globally, over $3 trillion. Why does a manufacturing superpower need a $3 trillion cushion?
It's the ultimate example of all these factors colliding. For decades, China ran massive trade surpluses, especially with the yuan. They were paid in dollars to prevent the yuan from appreciating too rapidly, which would have hurt their export machine. The People's Bank of China bought those incoming dollars with newly printed yuan. That's the primary mechanism of reserve accumulation. You print local currency to buy foreign currency. That action simultaneously builds the reserve pile and prevents your currency from strengthening.
Right, but how does that work in practice, day to day? Let's walk through it. A Chinese exporter sells $10 million worth of electronics to Walmart. They receive dollars into their bank account in Shanghai. The framework looks at potential outflows from things like a sudden stop in foreign investment, a collapse in export earnings, or domestic residents pulling money out of the country. The reserves are your firewall against those outflows. But here's a nuance. The IMF framework also differentiates between countries with flexible exchange rates and those with fixed rates.
It creates a massive side effect domestically. All that newly printed yuan flooding the system can lead to inflation, right? You're literally creating money.
That's the critical impact on domestic monetary policy. To counteract that inflationary pressure, the central bank then has to sterilize the intervention. They do this by selling bonds to mop up the excess yuan they just created. But these are guidelines, not laws. What pushes a country to actually build up a massive war chest beyond the minimum? Look at China.
The ultimate case study. Through the 2000s and 2010s, China accumulated reserves at a staggering pace, peaking at around $4 trillion before settling where it is now, at about $3.4 trillion. That wasn't just about import coverage. There's also the risk that the value of those dollar assets declines if the dollar weakens or if geopolitical tensions lead to complications. We've seen a preview of that.
And for other countries, the trade-off is more acute. Holding large reserves ties up capital that a developing economy might desperately need for investment. It's a sign of prudence, but also of a global financial system that forces you to self-insure because the ultimate backstop. The global lender of last resort comes with very strict strings attached. So you hoard your own safety net, but that safety net only really matters when it's put to the test.
And that's where the crisis management role comes in. All this theory is fine, but reserves prove their worth when the storm hits. They're the national fire extinguisher.
But Herman, that leads to a follow-up. What do you do with all those dollars? You can't just let them sit in a zero-interest account. When another wave of pressure hit, a combination of drought-hammering agricultural exports and global risk aversion, the central bank had almost no dollars left to defend the peso. They were out of ammunition.
Countries with persistent trade surpluses like China, Germany, Japan, they accumulate reserves almost passively. The flip side is countries with trade deficits. They're constantly drawing down their reserves or borrowing to cover the gap.
It went into freefall. And without reserves to provide liquidity to be the seller of dollars in the market, there was no circuit breaker. The IMF guidelines, do countries actually follow them, or are they more of a polite suggestion? It's the ultimate cautionary tale. Reserves are your first and most crucial line of defense against a full-blown balance of payments crisis.
For a country like Turkey or Argentina, hitting the IMF's adequacy metrics is a badge of credibility. It's a key number that rating agencies like Moody's and S&P scrutinize. For a reserve currency issuer like the United States, the calculation is completely different.
Because when your currency is the reserve, your need to hold other people's currency is minimal. Because if your currency is stable, the cost of imported goods, which is a huge component of consumer prices in many countries, is also stable. Wild currency swings translate directly into inflation or deflation.
No other country has that privilege, which is why they all hold dollars. It's the ultimate asymmetry, and that asymmetry is precisely what makes reserves so powerful.
And this is where the strategy diverges wildly between developed economies and emerging markets. Take the United States versus India. This asymmetry is the bedrock of the system. But it also creates a vulnerability for everyone else, which brings us to the active use of these reserves. Beyond just being a rainy day fund, reserves become a policy tool you can actively deploy to stabilize your economy once you have them.
We've covered the why hold them and the how much. Now we get to the fun part. How do governments actually use this pile of foreign money as a lever? For India, it's a non-negotiable pillar of economic sovereignty. It's what allows them to integrate into global finance without losing control. They need that shield.
Conversely, if your currency is getting too strong and hurting exporters, you can sell your own currency and buy dollars, adding to your reserves while pushing the value down. Developed nations with reserve currencies enjoy what's called an exorbitant privilege. They can fund deficits more easily and face less pressure to hold others' currencies. That's the billion-dollar question. You can for a while if your reserves are deep enough. But if you're fighting a fundamental loss of confidence, you will eventually run out of ammunition.
It's a bit of a fun fact, but this idea of an exorbitant privilege was first coined by a French finance minister in the 1960s, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. He was complaining about the unfair advantage the dollar's status gave the EU. It's a term that's been relevant for over half a century, and it still perfectly describes the tension today.
Reserves give you time and options, but they can't reverse a fundamental economic imbalance alone. If you're Poland or China and you see the dollar's share of global reserves falling, it's down to 57%, the lowest since 1994. And you remember what happened to Russia's frozen dollar assets in 2022, hoarding more dollars might start to feel like the wrong kind of insurance.
That's a geopolitical hedge in action. The data shows it clearly. As of February, central banks were net buyers of another 31 tons of gold. Poland alone added 20 tons in 1 month, aiming for gold to be 31% of its total reserves. 59% of central banks now store at least some gold domestically, a huge jump from 41% just 2 years ago. They're bringing it home. This isn't just about yield. It's about owning a physical, non-political asset that can't be frozen or devalued by another country's monetary policy.
The implication is that for emerging markets, reserves are evolving from a pure dollar-based crisis buffer into a more diversified strategic stockpile, with gold as the ultimate sovereignty play. It's fiscal policy meets foreign policy in the vault. But what does that mean for the average person?
Why should the headlines about foreign cash and gold bars matter to the everyday listener? What's the practical takeaway here for someone trying to make sense of it all?
Every dollar China parked in U-bonds was a dollar not lent to a Chinese small business or spent on domestic infrastructure. It represents a massive transfer of savings from a developing economy to finance the deficit of a developed one. Some economists argue this contributed to global imbalances and was a factor in the 2008 financial crisis.
It can distort global asset prices. The constant, massive demand from central banks for safe assets like U-treasuries pushes yields down artificially. What does that do? The practical advice is to follow a rules-based framework, like the IMF's metrics, but tailor it to your specific vulnerabilities, your dollar debt, your import needs, your exposure to commodity price swings.
When safe bond yields are suppressed by central bank buying, investors pour money into riskier assets like corporate debt, equities, or real estate, searching for yield. This can inflate prices beyond their fundamental values. But the geopolitical implications are even sharper. Reserves are economic weapons. We saw this starkly after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, and EU froze about half of Russia's $600 billion in reserves.
That was a seismic event. It wasn't a traditional seizure, but it made those assets unusable for defending the ruble or financing the war. It weaponized the very foundation of financial trust. It sent a shockwave through every finance ministry in the world. If your reserves are held in a jurisdiction that becomes hostile, they can be turned off.
And the global response has been a slow-motion earthquake. According to a World Gold Council survey this year, 59% of central banks are now storing more of their gold domestically rather than in traditional hubs like London or New York. They're seeking neutrality. A recent piece on investing.com called it the Great Gold Repatriation. Countries like Germany, the Netherlands, and even Venezuela have been physically moving their gold back home for years, a trend that has accelerated post-2022.
Because you can't freeze a gold bar sitting in your own vault. It's a physical asset free from counterparty risk. But gold isn't perfectly liquid. You can't make a digital payment with a bar of gold.
The next frontier is digital. How will central bank digital currencies, or even private cryptos, reshape reserve strategies? That event directly accelerated the diversification away from pure dollar reserves and into gold. Russia itself provides the case study for using reserves under sanctions. They had built up substantial reserves, including gold, for years.
That's a fascinating what if. Imagine if countries start holding reserves in a basket of CBDC tokens stored on a distributed ledger. The liquidity could be instant, but the cybersecurity risks and the question of who controls the ledger become monumental. It could make reserve management more efficient or introduce a whole new layer of systemic fragility.
It's the ultimate.
This episode was produced using DeepSeek v3.2. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.